Hello and welcome to Radio Edutalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay. I'm delighted to welcome to the show today Jonathan Firth. Welcome to Edutalk, Jonathan.
Hi there. Thanks very much.
Just to start off with, Jonathan, could you just give listeners a kind of brief background to your career and your time in education?
Sure. So I've been working in education for about 20 years now. I started off working abroad as a teacher of English as a foreign language. And about 15 years ago, I moved into teaching psychology in a secondary school. So that's been the bulk of my teaching time has been secondary school teaching. And more recently, I have taken up a post at University of Strathclyde working on working in teacher education. And I'm also doing a PhD part-time at Strathclyde as well.
And we're just going to talk for the next 15 minutes or so around a chapter that you wrote in a recent publication, Flip the System UK, A Teacher's Manifesto. Just wondering if you could tell us about how your involvement in the book came about.
Yeah, well, I was, it's funny, quite a few of the things I've done recently have come about through Twitter. My involvement with the book really just came about because I had pitched my chapter to the editors. But the reason I knew about it in the first place was because I followed the editors and quite a few other contributors on Twitter, so I was aware. It was a follow-up to a previous book called The System, which was, it's not actually long ago, it was 2015 or something like that, that was co-authored by the two, I believe, Belgian authors. The idea was really to follow up with a UK-wide publication focused on issues, particularly in Britain. I contributed to authors in Georgia, Scotland, and the rest are predominantly based in England, but there are a few other international authors as well.
And the whole book and your chapter in particular kind of extols the benefits of kind of research-based knowledge into learning. So can you just take us through the kind of main argument in your chapter?
Sure. So, I mean, the idea of the book in general, with the title The System, the idea is really to think about how teachers can be put in charge of the education process more rather than it being very top-down, what to do, basically. And in my chapter, I'm linking that with research. One of the points I've tried to make in the chapter is that educational research can be seen as a bit of a threatening thing for teachers if you have a scenario where governments or somebody else on behalf of governments is saying, you need to do this to be a good teacher, or this is what's effective, so everyone needs to do this, and then perhaps check via processes like Ofsted or whatever that this is actually being done. And the argument I'm trying to make is that it's quite empowering for teachers to inform themselves of educational research, about memory in particular is what I'm focusing on in the chapter, because it puts them in the driving seat to make these decisions. And if you know your own context and you know about the research, you're in a better position than anyone else really to say what's going to be effective and what's going to work for your learners.
And this all kind of fits into I remember when I was doing my own ED, kind of fits into notions of accountability versus autonomy.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I think accountability is one of the things I talk about in the chapter, and doing some research in the run-up to writing the chapter, I was looking into some of the history of this because I've been in education for a while, but I didn't know all the background to it, and I certainly got the sense from my reading that the level of accountability, the level of sort of top-down control of education, has gradually increased over the decades that you used to have teachers being very autonomous in the classroom, to the extent of, at some point there wasn't even a national curriculum telling you what you should be teaching. It's moved more to a process where the content, at least, of education is quite top-down, but we probably still, certainly in my teaching experience anyway, have a fair amount of control over how it's delivered. And I suppose the concern is that accountability processes could move into that territory we're telling teachers, well, this is effective and this is not, so you have to do it this way and we will check whether you're doing it. So very much so, yeah, it does speak to that debate.
And you, as you say, you focus on kind of research into learning and memory. So, and you kind of criticise the sort of common sense notions and some of the nonsense around learning and memory. So, could you just kind of take listeners through some of these?
Yeah. So, my research interests are very much in long-term memory. And I mentioned that I'm doing a PhD, but even before that, in the kind of run-up to that, I was very interested in learning and memory and cognition because I have a psychology degree, and that was my background. I was teaching psychology. But it took me a while before I realized that this could actually be quite useful for my professional practice as well. It took me surprisingly long, perhaps, to make the links there. But I started looking into things like the spacing effect, which is a phenomenon in memory that if you space out two instances of practice, so learning something and then practicing at a later point, that the more you space that out, the more effective it is over the long term in terms of how well something is remembered. So obviously we want our learners not to forget things, we want them to remember them in the exam or in their future life. So it was very intriguing to me to look into that research, how just altering the timing of when we do things can make a big difference to the outcome. And it struck me as, in many ways, this should be part of teachers' professional knowledge. So we don't just know how to do something, but we know when to do it. And really just looking into that area of research kind of led me into quite a few other areas of the psychology of memory and a whole field of research of how this is beginning to be applied increasingly in schools.
And so what are the implications then for professional learning? You know, would you argue then that there needs to be more kind of explicit training and then practical experience of these better strategies that you've touched upon?
Sure. I mean, I think there is an argument for making them part of initial teacher education. There's an argument for making it part of continuing professional learning as well, because I think a lot of CPD is quite subject based. I don't want to sit and criticize it. Some of it is very, very valuable. It's a lot of things that teachers have to do as part of the professional learning, but I think it certainly is a process that's beneficial, and particularly once you've actually been in the profession for a while and then you have something to apply it to. I think with initial teacher education, it's good for teachers to have an awareness of this as they set out on their careers. But it's probably an ongoing process to engage with research. That's why I suppose I encourage teachers to get engaged, to get the skills to engage with research, to keep themselves up to date. There's going to be new things coming out all the time that are relevant for teachers. So having the skills and the interest to engage with that, possibly as part of their own research project, but not necessarily. You could be simply reading other people's stuff. But if you engage with, if you get involved with research projects yourself, I think that's a very good stimulus, whether it's an action research type thing or a more formal thing. It's a really good stimulus for delving into the research and finding out about it and thinking about it. As you mentioned in your previous question, I think there's the alternative is the kind of common sense approach to learning and memory. And when you look at the research into metacognition, a lot of assumptions about learning are quite flawed. A lot of assumptions that are quite widely held are flawed. So if you look at students, for example, even people who have gone through school and university, so they've been students for quite a long time, they don't seem to pick up effective learning strategies just through trial and error. So they tend to stick to very ineffective strategies, such as repeatedly rereading things, when it would be much more effective, for example, to test themselves on the material. And I think in a similar way, we can't really rely on teachers picking these things up just by chance, or if they apply their common sense assumptions about memory that they have prior to becoming teachers, it's quite possible those are flawed as well. So I suppose I'm arguing for this being part of our professional knowledge. Obviously nobody's going to have perfect knowledge of this area because they're not going to be experts in cognitive psychology alongside being experts in their teaching area, but at least having an engagement with that and being aware of some of the major phenomena that are out there. I think it would be very valuable.
And just returning to the key evidence that you reference in the book chapter in terms of time, you also talk about the research that suggests that immediate feedback is not necessarily the best approach.
Yeah, it's a bit counterintuitive, as I said, about a few of the things, a few of the memory concepts that I talk about in the book. We generally have this idea that it's a good idea to give somebody some quick feedback. And not often it will be, but there's also some evidence that suggests that delaying the feedback could be beneficial. And one reason for that could be that it might prompt a learner to figure things out themselves rather than be told what's right or what's wrong about something, about a piece of work, for example. And if they do that, it may actually be a more active form of learning. It may be more memorable because they'll remember the process of figuring that out or checking it themselves. So a lot of the things that we might do because we're trying to be helpful and we're trying to be, you know, to benefit our students, such as giving them lots and lots of feedback, could be slightly counterproductive because they could become quite dependent on that feedback, and they could sort of fail to explore methods for gaining feedback themselves more independently. So it's that kind of thing that I think is certainly worth thinking about and making a professional judgment over. Again, I suppose the kind of theme for the whole chapter is I'm not saying that this is a strategy and we should all use it. That's more of a sort of top-down, one-size-fits-all approach. It is still about professional judgment, but it's about having professional judgment which is informed by evidence and weighing up the evidence for your own particular context.
So when we're talking about evidence-based professionalism then, Jonathan, what would be the ideal conditions for this to develop, and what role do the authorities, in whichever shape or form, do they have to play?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There are a couple of other chapters in the book that talk about some of the systems and the context, things like teaching professional bodies, things like Chartered College for Teaching, things like systems for encouraging teacher engagement with research, things like the position of the research lead who could perhaps pilot that in within the school and disseminate ideas to other colleagues. Certainly you need some kind of support for it to work well, ideally some institutional support in the form of some time on behalf, you know, some time within your timetable to work on research projects or to engage with research, because otherwise teachers who already have very heavy workloads are going to be expected to kind of also be part-time researchers as well, which is perhaps unrealistic. So obviously that kind of comes down to money. I was at the Scottish Learning Festival last year, and one of the things the International Council of Advisors, the Scottish Government, said that Scotland has, Scottish teachers have, I think it was the second smallest amount of free sort of blank space in their timetables over the working week out of any country in the developed world. So clearly Scottish teachers already have quite a lot of demand. And I think freeing up some space for professional learning on a regular basis rather than the occasional in-service days is very beneficial.
We're just coming near to the end, Jonathan. I'm just wondering, just kind of going back to the title of the publication, can you say a bit more about what flipping in its broadest sense kind of means, about what it means to you, and also in terms of, can you give us a wee bit more about how you actually use, for example, Twitter from a professional engagement or professional learning point of view?
Something like Twitter is really good for sharing ideas. There's various Twitter chats, so if people, if listeners are not aware of those, there's kind of regular times during the week where you can chat about particular things. So there's chats about research evidence in education, there's chats about different subject areas in primary and science and that kind of thing. So that's a really good way of sharing practice, and that includes, you know, evidence-based practice and relevant research evidence. There's one called CogSciSci that I'm a member of, so there's hashtag CogSci, SCI, SCI. So it's cognitive science applied to science, basically. That's the abbreviation for it. So essentially, this is a group of science teachers around the UK who share cognitive science evidence, a lot of things to do with things like memory, and talk about how they can apply that to the science classroom. So I found that very helpful. There's an email group involved with that as well. But certainly a lot of these contacts are initially made through Twitter, and people find out about the network through Twitter. So it's great for that. Twitter is also a really easy way of just sharing articles. So if there's a blog post about a particular area of research or a journal article, it's a great way of sharing it. And it just stays, you know, publicly available if anyone comes across it later.
And just finally, kind of sticking with that theme of the kind of grassroots activity and grassroots movement, you know, that's something that's always been very close to my heart. But you appear in the article to kind of link that to the possibility of effective kind of research and evidence-based professionalism. So are there examples then of maybe, whether it's online or face-to-face, of where grassroots movements are engaging with research or actually generating data and actually working together on research projects?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few. I mean, there's some quite large-scale things, such as Perigoo and ResearchEd. There's kind of UK-wide or, you know, national-based organisations which are encouraging meetups and conferences at grassroots level. So it's not something that's being mandated by schools or by the government. And I think there's a real feeling that teachers want to get engaged with this, that they want to find out things that can benefit their practice. I mean, some of these things, I did talk about how it's demanding and something would be beneficial to have for teachers to have time on the timetable, but there's also the potential for evidence-based practice to benefit somebody's, to be beneficial in terms of the amount of time it takes to teach something. Because if you teach something more efficiently, if learners remember it and don't forget it, then that's actually going to save time because you don't need to reteach it. So I think there's a real desire, a real hunger to engage with research and to find how it will benefit people's practice on a grassroots level. So as well as these larger national organisations, I think you do see it on a school level, on a local authority level in Scotland. I was just at an event here at Strathclyde where some of the NQT, some of our new teachers who have been in schools from last year and they're on their probationary placements, we're talking about school-based sharing of practice and evidence-based practice. So I think there really is a grassroots movement that has developed and is increasing, in my view.
Jonathan, thank you so much for taking time out this afternoon to join us on Radio EduTalk. And I just wonder if you could leave listeners with a couple of places maybe to visit online, whether that's the Flip the System UK or to find out more about your own work.
Sure, yeah. So Flip the System UK has its own website. So if you Google Flip the System UK, you'll find that and you can get the book through the usual places. It just came out at the end of last year. My own recent co-authored book, Psychology in the Classroom, talks about some quite similar issues such as memory, but also covers things like creativity, self-directed learning. It's co-authored with Mark Smith, who's a fellow psychology teacher down south, and he talks a lot about things like motivation and emotion. So Psychology in the Classroom also is quite recent, just came out in February this year. I've been to delve into the theories of how psychology evidence can impact on learning in various ways.